out of touch with Americans. The Supreme Court is seen as making political rather than legal decisions. The press is seen as biased and more interested in driving narrative over facts. Smear tactics against people work better than ever, as gossip fueled by anonymous sources has become the coin of the realm. The most fundamental tenet of the system that America's founders set up, that ours should be a representative democracy run by educated elites as opposed to direct democracy, is under question. This disconnect led to the populist revolution of 2016 and the silent overthrow of the elite guardians. These elites are still in power, and yet in many ways they are a walking dead, seen as unable to act on anything and wedded to egghead principles that make no sense. The election of 2016 is a case in point. The collective elites simply failed to see Donald Trump coming. I certainly did not imagine him becoming as powerful as he did, but I also couldn't ignore the ease with which he dispatched 17 candidates in the Republican Party by simply ripping off their masks. Jeb Bush, the consensus elite candidate, failed to even get out of the gate, despite nearly $200 million of early funding. GOP primary voters revolted against a Republican establishment they thought had grown cozy with the Democratic establishment, hadn't stood up to President Barack Obama, and probably could not stop Hillary Clinton from winning the election. The Republican elites even continued warring with Trump well after he got the nomination. They came to believe that they, and not the voters, were the party. The fountains of elite information all said that the victory of Hillary Clinton was inevitable, and the elites all believed it. They did not see what was happening right before their eyes right here in America. Every blow to Trump was seen as the coup de grace, yet he kept fighting back. Many elites continued to hold former President Bill Clinton in high regard, despite a checkered history with women, while assuming a crude audio tape would be the end of Donald Trump. And even in the aftermath, impressionable elites remain on the edge of their seats, in a world of Russian conspiracies and James Comey missteps, still waiting for the deus ex machina to bring the tragedy of 2016 to a close. But these, as well as other blinders, are just ways of denying the sea change of the rebellion of 2016. When you add up all the votes in the congressional races, the Republicans were the winners of the national popular vote. The Democrats lost 1,000 legislative seats at all levels under President Barack Obama, and yet cling to a fantasy that the country is overwhelmingly liberal when the obvious facts staring at them are quite different. Today, you can sit down with an impressionable elite, a Harvard-educated lawyer, for example, and they know with absolute certainty that somehow Trump was laundering money with the Russians in exchange for help in the election. They have no evidence for these claims, and yet they know it just as strongly as elites once believed with absolute certainty that the earth was flat. So did the Russians need money? How, when $2.4 billion was spent on the election campaign, would $100,000 worth of Facebook ads make a difference? It's illogical, and yet perhaps 40% of those hearing this paragraph have come to believe it, based on reports of completely classified unknowable information. They just know it. The reason why working-class voters supported Trump also confirms the impressionable elite theory. Both Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump were disliked by about two-thirds of the voters. About a third of those who voted for Clinton disliked her. About a third of those voting for Trump disliked him. In what was the most intensely personal and negative campaign I have ever witnessed, it was middle and working class voters concerned about issues that swung the election in favor of Donald Trump. These largely Midwestern voters certainly did not love the Donald Trump of Access Hollywood who talked about assaulting women, but they believed that his basic analysis of the country was right, that political correctness had gone too far, that we didn't control our border, that there was war on the police, that trade deals had eroded our manufacturing and cost us jobs, and that Washington needed a wake-up call. Agree or disagree with these voters, their political and issue perspective is clear, and they voted Trump. and many had voted for Obama, for these very tangible reasons that elites have all but ignored. The traditional cultural Republicans, who voted based on religion and guns, also supported Trump as they had all the other Republicans, but it was Trump's seizing of these new issues that broadened his coalition and brought him victory. Today, there is an impressionable elite echo chamber. Think tanks tell elites what to think, and the New York Times and the rest of the media echo it, and voila! Sit down in the country club in New Jersey, and most are armed with the very same talking points. The Southern Poverty Law Center sets the standard on cultural issues, and the Tax Policy Center sets the standard on tax and economic issues. Partisan analysts drum up a report that is never questioned and spoon-fed to elites through the media. Of course, the right has had their own echo chamber for some time, with Fox News and the Drudge Report beaming out key points in similar fashion for ages. But the remarkable thing is that while the establishment media provided talking points for largely liberal elites, Fox and Drudge started to cater to voters instead, and dissociated themselves from the Republican elites, who are now basically adrift, disliked by the Democrats and largely abandoned by their own voters. President Barack Obama was in many ways the perfect impressionable elite president. He was an editor of the Harvard Law Review, had little Washington or governmental experience, and had, outside of his upbringing in Indonesia, traveled very little. He received the Nobel Peace Prize right off the bat. Though it might be counterintuitive, Facebook data suggests that elites actually have fewer international friends than people in lower social classes, only speaking to others with Ivy League educations and vacations to exotic locales. It's the lower-tier Americans who are actually hearing opinions from their immigrant friends, or from those outside a tiny, exclusive segment of the population. According to the University of Cambridge, reporting on a study using Facebook data, low social class people have nearly 50% more international friends than high social class people. The UK has shown a similar pattern, as elite sentiment diverged from the working class voters to produce the surprise vote on Brexit. Elites of almost all stripes were convinced that the EU was a good thing, and that calamity would befall Great Britain if it pulled out. Calamity, of course, failed to happen. Once again, elites living in their own fictional world of global and multicultural harmony became disconnected from people fearing the economic and cultural aspects of increased immigration and the open borders policy of the EU. Of course, the polls and analysis were so wrong about these two huge events that the Democratic Party fired its pollsters. The New York Times replaced its election unit, the BBC overhauled its polling operation, and Facebook and SurveyMonkey ended their partnership due to inaccurate polls. Actually, none of that happened. It does not appear that anyone got fired for all of this misdirection and the failure to understand the most basic forces happening in the world. Instead, they got promoted. Impressionable elites discovered they didn't have to be right. They simply needed to please a constituency that would stick with them. So, rather than address all of the economic and cultural missteps that produced these remarkable events, they went into the cocoon of denial and continued with business as usual. Polls once again proclaimed that Donald Trump is finished and has no support. Every proposal from Trump is ridiculed by a group of policy-skilled comedians and entertainers. The elites hold their noses, expecting that this too shall pass. They, after all, are the permanent Washington. Elites are no longer the ones we count upon to tell us right from wrong, or to apply their skills of expertise to move society forward. Instead, they are viewed increasingly as spinmeisters, telling tales that fit their narrowly defined worldviews. They have become even more distant from the broader population simply by rejecting what happened across two continents and reading books like Hillbilly Elegy, treating the other half as though they are zoo specimens. The implications of this disconnect remain profound, with no solution in sight. If a new independent party is created on either continent, it is unlikely to be the group of social liberals and economic conservatives we long thought would want a new party. It will instead be a populist party based on restoring power to the people and seizing it from the elites and the deep state. Trump was at the vanguard of this movement. And even if Trump works with the establishment as we know it is still in deep trouble. The underlying anger and concerns that produced Trump's victory are not being addressed in any meaningful way. The result is that our elites are becoming even more impressionable. 39. Militant Dreamers Revisited. Call them what you will today, depending upon your political perspective, but those who are here illegally without proper documentation have become, as predicted 10 years ago in the first microtrends, a major political force. This group may well be the most powerful force in the next presidential election. But as their electoral power has grown, so has a backlash that threatens them too. The voting population of Latinos has skyrocketed over the last decade. We saw that in 1992, the Latino vote was essentially at 2%. In 2016, it was at 11%. And there is still more potential for that number to grow. If you look at the states where significantly more voters turned out this election than last, it was New York, California, Texas, and Florida. Each with an average in the last two elections of over 900,000 more votes cast in the presidential contest. But there were 10% jumps in Latino voting in Colorado and Arizona as well. Colorado and New Mexico are pretty much out of reach now for a Republican. But a lot of the additional votes in Texas and Florida don't make much of a difference. In New York and California, the massive additional Latino votes are simply gilding the lily in national contests, and not making an electoral college difference whatsoever. The entire debate around this issue has evolved as we predicted in the first microtrends. Those here without legal status have been able to ally with those here legally, and the movement has a huge base in the key urban centers of the country. No mayor in New York, Los Angeles, Chicago, or Miami can get elected without a significant Latino vote. This has boosted the strength of the Latino vote both in absolute numbers nationally and especially within the Democratic Party. In 2008, Hillary Clinton didn't speak favorably about people coming into this country outside of the legal immigration system. In a 2003 radio interview, she said, "I am, you know, adamantly against illegal immigrants." She did not think some people should be able to jump the line past others, and said so both on the stump and many times behind closed doors. In 2016, the stronger together Hillary Clinton threw those views out the window. The more the campaign went on, the further to the left her views on immigration became. Clinton started out the 2016 campaign emphasizing comprehensive immigration reform and the tightening of our borders. By the end of the campaign, she was encouraged to stay away from even mentioning tightened borders. Interestingly, business is generally pro-immigration. They want more customers and more workers, especially cheaper workers. Perhaps the biggest change here is that unions, which by any logic typically oppose trade and immigration, now oppose trade but not immigration. Like the employers, unions have decided they will do a lot better if they can get more members, and worry less about the impact on wages of their existing workers. Unions even propagate the idea that adding millions of people to the workforce has no negative impact on the wages of their members, and is, after all, the right thing to do. But the growth of the open borders movement has run into a roadblock put up by President Trump and the American electorate, especially in Arizona, and from Indiana to Pennsylvania. The polling on immigration reflects not just a bifurcated electorate, but one that is solidly behind tight borders. They largely oppose building a wall, but they would support far more enforcement. They do believe in being compassionate to dreamers, and over 70% in the Harvard Caps Harris poll say that's an important priority. But 70% also reject the idea that police should not contact immigration authorities when they arrest people. The sanctuary city movement has no support outside of the sanctuary cities. If our political system were not fractured, we would have long ago tightened the borders, granted the people here work permits and a path to citizenship, and deported the criminals. But what's happened instead is that the right wants even tougher measures, including mass deportations, and the left wants open borders. This has put people like Marco Rubio, who supported a compromise, in the crossfire, and has increasingly widened the chasm. The demographic character of immigrants who came here illegally has in recent years been changing and may change again soon. Mexicans now make up less than half of those here illegally, and the ranks of Asian and Central American immigrants have been rising. Given what has happened in Syria, there is a surge in Middle Eastern immigrants trying to get into this country, and Trump has used fear of terrorism as a wedge on immigration to bar refugees and others from entering. California is on the cutting edge for the left and has passed laws to turn the entire state into a sanctuary state, telling law enforcement that they can't cooperate with immigration authorities when it comes to arresting people. The entire political dynamic in California has flipped around from the days of Pete Wilson, governor up until 1999, who spearheaded Proposition 187 to curb the use of state services by non-citizens. The Supreme Court declared it unconstitutional. As West Virginia went from one of the most Democratic states to a Republican state during this period, California swung heavily from a toss-up state that elected Ronald Reagan and Arnold Schwarzenegger to one of the most Democratic states. It was the growth of the Latino vote that made this possible, and this is why Democrats hope that over time, the same thing can happen in Texas, locking out the Republicans from the presidency. There are many organizations that want to galvanize the strong Latino population in Texas to make it a state that could potentially turn blue in 2020. Organizations like Battleground Texas that try to make Texas a swing state, in part by making Hispanic voters more engaged. More generally, we've seen a ton of new Hispanic-focused organizations sprout up in the last two decades. These organizations, like Voto Latino, Mi Gente, and Mi Familia Vota, are trying to raise Hispanic political and civic engagement, although the effects are unclear so far. 10 years ago in Microtrends, we noted that Latino voters are overwhelmingly Democratic, and they remain so today. A recent Pew study found that the Democratic Party affiliation of Latinos in America continues to climb. Despite a dip in 2006, because of the stronger Latino support for George W. Bush, over the past 10 years, the percentage of Latino registered voters has gone from 49% Democratic to holding steady around 63-64%. With this population's key values, including healthcare and education, it seems that the Democratic Party will retain these voters as a crucial part of their base in the foreseeable future. Based on recent migration and voter registration statistics, John Judas and Roy Teixeira wrote a highly influential book titled The Emerging Democratic Majority. They wrote that Democrats could simply rely on demographics and identity politics to make America a democratic country. But their analysis, like almost all analyses that depend upon the world standing still, was flawed, because it did not anticipate other demographic changes and the incredible ability of the two parties to adapt to changing times. Trump took anti-trade and anti-immigration policies that were policies championed not too long ago by the old left. By taking those issues away from the Democrats, Trump also took away a significant chunk of the working-class voters in areas that in fact had very few Latino voters. They wanted to avoid being the next area that would go through the kind of transformation these voters see in Florida, Texas, and California. Surprisingly, Trump did better, not worse, than Mitt Romney did with the Latino vote. And he took Florida, I believe, largely on the strength of a strong Cuban vote in the face of President Obama's opening up of relations with the dictatorship in Cuba. Obama took these measures as some of his last acts as president, and may have tipped the state over to Trump. Typically, it's the minority of Protestant Latinos who go for the Republicans, and that's still the case. The prognosis for what's going to happen here is less certain than 10 years ago. It was a no-brainer then that the power of undocumented immigrants would rise, and it has. But the reaction to these changes is at the core of the Republican-Trump counterwave. Perhaps Trump will be the Pete Wilson of America, and the last gasp before a complete reversal of these policies and a full path to citizenship to the 11 million who are here without legal status. Or perhaps he will arrest the traffic at the border, and the Latino voting population will see limited growth. Concentration in a few big states, as long as the Republicans hold on to Texas, also limits increased national impact. The U.S. Census counts all people here, and the appointment of seats includes non-citizens, so there will be a few changes in 2020. But as long as the states are winner-take-all, more seats in Texas and Arizona will mean more electoral votes for the Republicans, and the rest of the changes pretty much cancel themselves out. I would like to see comprehensive immigration reform get passed so the country could, if it worked, put this issue in the rearview mirror. But right now it looks like each side will move further and further apart, making this a critical flashpoint in American politics for another decade. 40. Newest Americans. When we talk about immigration, we tend to talk about Latin American countries and the Middle East. However, over the past decade, Asians are without a doubt the fastest growing immigrant population in America, more than those from any other region in the world. And Asian immigrants are experiencing incredible degrees of influence and success in America, from education to job opportunities to political influence. The Asian population in America has skyrocketed. In 1960, it was 5% of the foreign-born population and 30% of the nation's immigrants by 2014, according to Migration Policy Institute statistics. In 2010, Asian immigrants had higher naturalization rates in the U.S. than Hispanics, 261,370 for new Americans in 2015 out of the total 730,259. In 2016, there were an estimated 20.5 million Asian Americans living in the U.S., and the U.S. Census Bureau projects that number will reach 25.7 million by 2019. Asians were not always so welcome here. Geopolitical concerns, racism, and economics have had a profound impact on the Asian American experience, starting with the Chinese Exclusion Act in 1882. Remember that many Chinese were brought to California as part of the gold rush in conditions little better than slavery. As Chinese immigrants' population and economic power grew, however, outcry and fear resulted in the first major law restricting immigration to the United States. The act halted Chinese immigration for a decade and barred Chinese from becoming American citizens. It was not until the Immigration Act of 1965 that Chinese immigration on a large scale was allowed to begin again. The Japanese American population also met with similar policies. Teddy Roosevelt's Gentlemen's Agreement of 1907 was a U.S.-Japanese policy that held that no Japanese would be issued passports to immigrate to the U.S., except for certain categories of business and professional men. It was ended in the 1920s, but not long after, Pearl Harbor led to the internment of Japanese citizens here, an enormous animosity toward Japanese in America. Generations later, new governments and new attitudes toward Asia brought a new influx of immigration. In 1980, only 384,000 Chinese immigrants lived in the United States. In 2016, that number topped 2 million. During this same period, the total Asian immigrant population rose from 2.5 million to over 12.5 million. India is the number one Asian country sending its citizens to America, followed by China, the Philippines, Vietnam, and Korea. The most remarkable statistics about recent Asian immigrants lie in the economic success they are having in America. Asian Americans now have a median income of $74,829, 39% greater than the national average, and up from $66,000 in 2010. Given the widespread discussion about the impacts of racism and the long-standing caricatures of Asians, it is an incredible achievement. Asians are an immigration success story, even for the more conservative and fiscally minded, as they're bringing new tax revenue to the country. The conventional wisdom has been that a traditional Asian emphasis on merit and education, which dates back to Confucian times, has made the difference for this population's success. In fact, the educational gap of Asians today is huge. 30% of Americans over age 25 have a college degree, compared to half of Asian Americans. This certainly is significant enough to explain the pay gap we see today, as Asians are earning what they learn. The purchasing power of the Asian American community, then, is outsized compared to its population and is growing rapidly, with the community spending an impressive $825 billion annually. And their buying power, according to the Multicultural Economy 2015, is expected to increase by 32% by 2020. Asians in America tend to buy what upscale Asians buy in Asia. They eat 69% more fresh seafood than the average American, 72% more fresh vegetables, and 29% more fresh fruits, according to Nielsen research. And they also appreciate their gadgets. Asian Americans outpace the general population in ownership of smartphones, computers, tablets, sound systems, and other tech devices. From the same Nielsen research, of the 87 U.S. startup companies valued at $1 billion or more, 19 were founded by Asian American immigrants. Asian immigrants, especially those coming from businesses in China and India, are also often well-versed in the importance of scale and of managers and management. A $1 million business in the United States will likely have 6 employees, while a $1 million business will have 100 or 200 employees in India. At Microsoft, I worked for Satya Nadella, a model Indian immigrant born in a relatively small village. He worked head down at Microsoft for 22 years before rising to the logical choice of CEO. Intellectually, he was head and shoulders above his competitors, having a deep understanding of both the financial and technical sides of the cloud. His climb to into the management ranks, a common trend for Indian Americans, who have become the first immigrant group in this country to achieve a median income of over $100,000. There is always a chicken and egg question to the remarkable success that Asian Americans are having, but it's notable that 69% agreed when Pew Research asked if people who want to get ahead can make it if they work hard. Asian Americans are 11 points higher on this belief than the average American. Then again, this could merely reflect class sensibilities. Upper and middle class Americans of all races hold similar beliefs, with 71% and 67%, respectively, agreeing that hard work means getting ahead. Among lower-class Americans, only about half feel this way. The next generation of Asian Americans continues to show higher educational achievement than other demographics. Asians are about 5% of high school students, but make up 22% of the entering class at Harvard and 26% of the Massachusetts Institute of Technology freshman class. A look at the overall SAT scores shows Asian Americans significantly outscoring other Americans in math, which is, of course, a vital skill for advancement in the information age. The National Science Foundation reported that in 2012, Asian Americans earned around 6% of PhDs in science and engineering, while African Americans and Hispanic Americans earned 3% and 4% of such PhDs, respectively. A further 27% of 2012's science and engineering PhDs were earned by temporary visa holders, many of whom came from Asia. In Google's 2017 diversity report, the tech giant reported that 35% of its workforce was Asian or Asian American, up from 30% just 4 years earlier. While economic success is generally correlated with voting Republican, Asians have been moving sharply to the Democratic Party in the last few elections. As the population has grown, it has flipped from over 50% Republican to over 70% Democratic. Americans from India are most likely to be Democrats, while Chinese Americans are most likely to be Republicans. In this group, early Republican support was based on the anti-communist and strong-on-defense stance of the party, which would attract those who had real concerns about Mao Zedong and the Cultural Revolution. But today's immigrants have few such concerns, and those from India and the Philippines, for example, are more concerned about social justice issues here in the U.S. than about foreign policy. Having said that, Asian voters are also fairly concentrated in less competitive states. The largest populations are in California and New York. While they are now also going to the South and the Midwest, they have had a fairly minor impact on national politics because their vote is small in core swing states. Their high level of success, however, shows that Republicans might have some success in winning voters back with the right kinds of candidates. Trump got 27% of the Asian American vote. The Justice Department's backing of the Asian American student's suit against Harvard was politically brilliant. It was a backdoor way to oppose affirmative action and at the same time showed that perhaps the interests of Asian American voters are not with the Democratic Party. At these income levels, Asians are big taxpayers, and their concerns may flip toward a better environment for business, lower taxes, and race-blind admissions to colleges over affirmative action. Asian Americans are, however, starting to run for office in growing numbers. The 2015 congressional swearing-in had notable Asian firsts. Senator Tammy Duckworth, Democrat from Illinois, became the first Thai American elected to the Senate. And Representative Stephanie Murphy, Democrat from Florida, was the first Vietnamese American woman elected to Congress. In total, there are now 18 Asian Americans and Pacific Islanders in Congress, up from 14 in 2016. When I was growing up, the pop culture image of the Asian was represented by Hop Singh, the efficient and affable cook on the most popular TV show of that time, Bonanza. Things have come a long way since then, but Asians are still often depicted in stereotypes. The recent show Fresh Off the Boat, set in the 1990s, when Asian immigration was new, is the first TV show with an Asian lead character in 20 years. On the big screen, movies like Slumdog Millionaire and The Best Exotic Marigold Hotel were commercial successes that put India in a generally good light. But successes are not without setbacks. Recently, Grace Park refused to re-up with Hawaii Five-O unless its producers paid its Asian American leads the same as the white leads of the show, walking off rather than taking less. The studios also paid a high price for casting Scarlett Johansson in Ghost in the Shell, in which she played a very famous and beloved Japanese anime character. The film did not recoup its production and marketing costs. Only one out of every 20 speaking roles in American films go to Asians, and only 1% of leading roles. This will change in time. There will continue to be more Asian American experiences being told on screen, like the lauded Emmy Award-winning Master of None, written by comedians Aziz Ansari and Alan Yang, which devotes several episodes to the childhood experience of Asian immigrants. There is also an increased drive to feature more Asians in big movies, fueled by the growth of the Chinese entertainment marketplace. A movie that opens in the U.S. can now be a success or failure based entirely on how it does at the Chinese box office. With rapid double-digit growth in Asian immigration over the last 20 years, expect the cultural influence of Asian Americans to continue to increase. Likewise, this group will continue to pack a serious economic punch. And given their powerful influence in technology companies, Asian Americans may well be America's secret weapon in the race to stay ahead in innovation and technology. 41. Couch potato voters. Swing remains king when it comes to our elections. But President Donald Trump rewrote the playbook to shift the edge in American politics from soccer moms to football dads. And he began to attract back to politics a new group of those voters just on the fringe of participating in politics. As the power of mass communications has expanded, the percentage of people who vote in our elections has barely budged, increasing basically with population growth. Some demographics, like the African American community, focused on organizing and increasing their voting strength. But others dropped out and became couch potato voters. Some of these voters are getting off the couch now and represent the biggest untapped political resource for future candidates and elections. The couch potatoes are created by the voluntary nature of participation in the political system. You need to get a Social Security card at birth, and you need a photo ID to get on a plane. However, no forces require you to register to vote or to get out and do it. Political participation and power go to those in America who actively choose to turn off the TV and vote. Those who stayed on the couch lost their power in each election, 2016 included. But candidates have an opportunity for subsequent elections to motivate a new slice of those voters and get them to the polls. In 2016, about 224 million people were eligible to vote, and about 137 million voted. Even though turnout went up from 2012, the couch potato vote, people eligible but not voting, was still nearly 90 million citizens. Educated voters, women, and older voters have high turnout rates in this country. Men, young people, and the less educated have much lower rates, as do Hispanics and Asians. There are 54 million white voters on the couch compared to about 19 million Asians and Hispanics. African-American turnout, while down from 2012, was still higher than turnout among white guys without a college education. So the unexpected secret locked in the numbers is that the largest untapped number of voters who have become these couch potatoes are lower-educated white male voters, precisely the voters who could be energized by a populist campaign. There are tens of millions of those voters, and even though the Hispanic vote and the Asian vote both underperform and have room to grow, they are still much smaller in numbers than the non-college whites who are political dropouts. And most of the white male non-voters are located outside of the swing states, which might complicate things for anyone who wants to switch to a popular vote. Such a change would cause a huge race to get voters off the couch everywhere, fundamentally changing how the campaigns are run. Donald Trump may have gotten fewer votes than Hillary Clinton, but he also got the highest number of votes ever received by a Republican candidate, coming in at nearly 63 million votes, while Hillary got nearly 66 million. Clinton didn't have the highest number of votes for a Democrat. That honor goes to President Barack Obama, who got a record 69 million against John McCain. The Libertarian Party also surged to a record number of votes, and it's unclear how they would have broken in the two-way popular vote system. Trump brought in several million who had never voted in a Republican primary before, and those voters were no doubt critical in his winning the Electoral College. That's right. His ace in the hole was the couch potato vote. Two changes have facilitated the shift from just going after swing voters to targeting a slice of the couch potatoes. One is the vast expansion of funds available to presidential races since Barack Obama became the first candidate in decades to turn down limits and federal matching. The second is the rise of the internet and micro-targeted digital ads, tools that did not exist in politics 10 years ago, but now get multi-billion dollar checks. As I have written, don't expect that $100,000 in ads from Russian accounts tip the election. That's a pittance compared to $2.4 billion spent by the 2016 presidential campaigns, most of which would have gone into a limited number of swing states. But the internet does allow an added degree of personal targeting that should be better than targeting the right TV show, the previous best practice. For instance, President Barack Obama and his team did an incredible job of targeting and energizing the black community. As a result, African-American voters overperformed white voters in turnout, especially in key swing states, over the course of two elections. In 2016, African-American turnout remained high, but not as high as 2012. And it was not as high in a place like Ohio. In 2012, 15% of votes in Ohio were cast by African-Americans, while only 10% are African-American in the census there. This means that in 2012, the African-American vote in Ohio was so energized that it overperformed compared to the census by 50%. Trump and his campaign team had to pull out record numbers of sympathetic voters in swing states across the Midwest and in Florida to produce an upset, a strategy largely based on energizing a new group of white working-class voters that felt left behind. On the other end of the spectrum, Bernie Sanders, the Democratic presidential nominee hopeful who lost to Senator Hillary Clinton, energized young people and progressive voters with his message about free college and breaking up the big banks. By targeting those communities, he also brought in new voters who were drawn to a long-shot candidacy and made them a powerful force. Most people in this country believe in immigration policies that allow a path for citizenship and want their borders strengthened. Both are fairly sensible policies. But those who can be animated to vote when they typically stay home are likely to be more on the fringes rather than the mainstream. These are people who want fully closed or open borders, and it's the extremes, not the sensible solutions, that increase turnout. Similarly, recent polls find that most Americans support trade, and yet the most powerful movements in politics today play off economic anger and resentment, along with xenophobia. The marginal voters were moved by anti-trade policies. The rise of the couch potato voter is also not just an American trend by any means. Take a look at Brexit, the vote for the United Kingdom to leave the European Union in summer of 2016, brought out voters who were motivated by fear of immigration from Syria and other countries in the Middle East. It only took a small group of very passionate people to throw off all of the polling models and upend the experts entirely. We are seeing the same forces taking hold in France and elsewhere in Europe after several terror attacks that have racked those countries. Even Germany has seen its governing coalition collapse. The implications of the new strategy, whereby campaigns target identity and fringe groups to win, are huge. If there is a marginal voter shift from being a middle-class suburban family to angry working-class voters on the right, or to socialists on the left, our elections will increasingly tear us apart rather than bring us together. The campaigns will pander to baser feelings and emotions rather than to the sensible solutions of the new center. The choices emerging from the primaries will be even more polarized, and the general election campaign will be caustic, scorched-earth campaigns. Rather than reaching compromises on issues like trade, the environment, and immigration, we will be driven to even further gridlock or executive orders that most of the country oppose, creating a vicious spiral downward and a collapse of faith in our political system. The answer? Paradoxically, we have to reduce the couch potato voter population by half or more by inviting them into the broader voting population. This would break the system wherein huge benefits accrue from motivating the 10% on the outside rather than working across aisles to attract swing voters. Universal voting would fix the problem, but most believe voting should be voluntary. Let's start with reforming voter registration. Start it at birth, like Social Security, and set up a national database allowing voters to simply switch their registration from state to state. End this antiquated patchwork system. Second, we need to make voting easier while keeping it private. That may mean initiatives like voting online, but other options include enabling places like ATMs, which use an already secure and available network for transactions, to function as voting terminals, and Tuesday voting should be replaced by a full weekend of voting. The Tuesday model is outdated and isn't working. One thing that is important, though, is the secret ballot. No one should ever be able to see how you are voting, especially before you vote, which could enable blackmail or harassment. We also need to abolish caucuses. It's not a fair process in the 21st century, and they give even more power to the activist fringes because of their low turnout. Primaries should rotate an order of states, perhaps even by lottery, to stop the gaming of New Hampshire and Iowa. We need to think overall about how this system has to change, rotating the geographic order so that no one block of voters becomes a gatekeeper to the presidency. I personally prefer the Electoral College to a straight popular vote, because if we overcome the couch potato voter problem, it mostly requires candidates to pander to the center. I worry what today's multi-billion dollar campaigns would become if you could win by getting every New Yorker and Californian to the polls. I believe that a close election would result in a civil war, as votes would need to be recounted, not in a few swing states, but in every single district in the land. In theory, I would like to see the popular vote govern, but given today's America and its litigious nature, I'm not sure we could handle it. Any popular vote would require a runoff to save it from becoming a game of creating splinter candidacies and spoilers. An interesting variation would be for minor candidates to give their votes to one of the top two if they fail to get elected. We all looked at our TV sets in amazement in this past election, watching candidates calling for mass deportation or tearing down our economic system. We have not updated and modernized our democracy as we have grown, nor have we taken advantage of the technology and innovation that makes it easier today to get a car and drive than it is to vote. The result is that in modern politics, the fringe can be gamed to be more powerful than the mainstream, and that will tear us apart if we fail to see what is happening and fix it. Section 6. Work and Business. 42. Self-data lovers. 43. Bikers to work. 44. Virtual entrepreneurs. 45. Microcapitalists. 46. The fakesters. 47. Work with limits. 48. The new factory worker. 49. Hazel reborn. 50. 10 times millionaires. 42. Self-data lovers. An intriguing new pastime has overtaken stepping on the scale. More and more of us are now body policing our every move, using technology to gather up-to-the-minute data on ourselves. Satirist David Sedaris, in a piece for The New Yorker, described his obsession with his new Fitbit. During the first few weeks that I had it, I'd returned to my hotel at the end of the day, and when I discovered that I'd taken a total of, say, 12,000 steps, I'd go out for another 3,000. Why the extra steps? Because, he explained, my Fitbit thinks I can do better. Self-data lovers are the new Wall Street traders, data addicts of a different kind. When one's life revolves solely around data, one begins to have a mindset that sinks or soars by the numbers coming in. It can grow into an obsession, and it turns out that Sedaris is not alone in the self-monitoring craze. According to a recent Harvard Caps Harris poll that surveyed a representative sample of Americans, over 40% of us are tracking at least some kind of health information, such as steps or heart rates. Men are more likely to track their health than women, and younger adults are more likely than older adults. Young urbanites are the most likely culprits, while their rural counterparts are the least likely. Of those who do track their health data, 58% reported using their phones. Another 28% of these track-happy respondents said they used their watch for tracking, while 19% used a Wi-Fi-enabled scale, and 35% used other devices. Some of these respondents obviously use multiple devices. It's not just steps or weight we're life logging. It's practically anything that can be measured in our daily lives. Fitness, mood, sleep, spending, menstrual cycle, food intake, symptoms, treatments, diaper deliveries, pizza deliveries, movement through space, social networks, addictions, and so on. The possibilities are endless. Too much television watching? Log it. Worried about your sperm count? Track it. Or concerned about future injury prevention? Potential tumors? Both can be monitored through data. But are we being data delusional? There's a dark side here, as self-data tracking can get addictive. There's also an extremism to how far people are going with self-tracking things. And the results, of step logging for instance, are not necessarily that one is achieving better health. The process can be merely time-wasting or compulsive. It can even lead to very unhealthy behaviors. A new study found that sleep trackers are actually bad for your health, according to a recent article in the Journal of Clinical Sleep Medicine. Participants can become fixated on the number of hours to sleep and end up, paradoxically, lying awake, obsessed with the data. Moreover, the study determined that the monitors used weren't even able to evaluate one's sleep results accurately. In essence, self-tracking creates worse sleep habits. More noise, more fuss, less rest. Gary Wolf, editor at Wired Magazine, who, along with co-editor Kevin Kelly, first coined the term the quantified self, QS, noted that people might jump to conclusions and see negative effects of constant self-tracking. He offered a different view in a 2010 TED Talk. We know that numbers are useful for us when we advertise, manage, govern, search, but they're also useful when we reflect, learn, remember, and want to improve. While most people think of these tools as pointing outward as windows, they also turn inward and become mirrors for self-discovery, self-awareness, self-improvement, self-knowledge. Wolf's QSers agree. In fact, they meet up at large conferences with as many as several thousand participants, and the movement has spread internationally to more than 100 groups in 30 countries. Topics include geotracking, DNA sequencing, chemical body load counts, personal genome sequencing, behavior monitoring, location tracking, non-invasive probing, etc. They also shared resources and videos and discussed newer and better technologies hitting the scene. And there are plenty. Sure, geeky biometric gadgetry can be a means for self-revelation, helping you track your sleep apnea or daily caloric intake. But what's most surprising from these self-data lovers is that while a growing number of consumers are concerned about data mining and big data tracking by industries, many life loggers seem more than willing to share personal information with whoever is interested. Supplying health symptoms and treatments to patients like me and Cure together. Playlists and the number of times they've listened to a particular song to Spotify, and the number of calories they just ate at dinner to too many apps to mention. Orange Theory Fitness and CrossFit post workout results on screens throughout their facilities to encourage members to work harder. GPS tracking app Strava gathers where you've been and sells it to city planners, while Ototo does the same for public transportation. Yet while we still struggle to navigate the delicate balance of private and public data, devices to log, track, and share are flying off the shelves. MyFitnessPal, which was just acquired by Under Armour in 2015 for $475 million, has 165 million users. Lose It claimed 17 million users in 2014. Samsung recently filed for a patent that would install a body fat sensor in their phones. People are lining up. The period app Clue has over 2.5 million users worldwide. Of the concerns surrounding the self-tracking movement, those that tap into the big data debate are perhaps the most notable. With the installation of one sensor at under $1 to produce, whole industries can amass mountains of information on their customers. As other institutions do the same, one has to step back and wonder what kind of surveillance environment we're building. Governments from local to national use personal data to trade figures. Hospitals gather waiting times and exam results. Companies manage turnover, assess what we're buying, and review our complaints. Almost all banks have some kind of tracking apps for customers, while PayScale's Salary Survey has the largest database of individual compensation profiles in the world. Not just large organizations with deep pockets, but small organizations and nonprofits, even mom-and-pop stores, can get enough personal information about customers to understand our habits. In some industries, this is not bad news, particularly when it comes to advancements in medicine. Talk to people with chronic social anxiety or back problems, HIV medication concerns, Parkinson's, or epilepsy. Personal data has helped ease symptoms and log warning signs. Take, for example, Asmopolis, a startup in Madison, Wisconsin. They've developed a device called the Spiro Scout that can attach to an asthma inhaler and, through satellite positioning data, allow patients and doctors to examine their environments. Based on this information, researchers are understanding more about particular crops and environmental conditions and how they affect people with lung and asthma problems. In Deborah Lupton's book, The Quantified Self, she says there are five kinds of self-data trackers: private, communal, pushed, imposed, and exploited. She warns that even if monitoring offers positive outcome and motivation, say through fitness and diet, accuracy, consistency, and sustainability are also key. If one were to study self-data trends, one might look to the younger generations to see what's on the horizon. According to a CNBC report, U.S. teens and young adults are clocking up more hours on social media, a new survey has found, but at the same time sharing less and growing frustrated with friends who overshare. The report goes on to say that of the 812 teens and young adults surveyed, roughly three-quarters said they spent the same or more amount of time on social media sites compared to a year ago. However, two-thirds said they had stopped sharing as much information as they used to. Four-fifths complained that people their age share too much. But for now, there's a loyal following of self-data exhibitionists who don't seem to be slowing their sharing anytime soon, nor will they be deterred by big data using their personal information for their own benefit. Why? According to Jennifer Hurst at Truman State University, the desire for social connectedness and the positive feelings some get from the environment must be worth the time, energy, and sacrifice. At Harvard, they have been experimenting with a personal data can, a receptacle for all the data people generate about themselves across all of their activities and apps. Admission to the can is then sold to the highest bidder for your data. If you are someone with a disease or a love for chocolate cookies, you can expect either medical researchers or candy manufacturers to buy your data, and you will be able to monetize your hobby of self-data loving. It's one way to turn a passion into something productive. It might not be the people in lab coats who find the cure to certain diseases. It might just be these movements of life loggers who ping their way to new discoveries, new cures, or even just new pain relief. The potential is high, as are the risks to privacy, but I expect as data becomes the central and most powerful currency, the micro-trend of self-data lovers will grow, and more of us will keep all of the data we generate from birth to death and beyond. 43. Bikers to work. Almost every major city has torn up their roads and made an environmental statement in an attempt to curb global warming by adding bike lanes to their primary commuter roads. The response has not been overwhelming, but it's no longer uncommon to see helmeted commuters in business suits racing by your car as you sit stuck in traffic. The Great Recession clearly had a role in Americans ditching cars for public transportation, walking or biking as gas prices shot up before they shot down. According to the Federal Highway Administration, during the first 10 years of this century, Americans in each age group were driving less than in previous decades. The youngest of these groups, teens and young adults ages 16 to 30, had the sharpest drop, whether it's because a family couldn't provide a teen with a car or because teens